It's the TEH Podcast, episode number 221, with Leo Nautenboom of AskLeo.com and Gary Rosenzweig of MacMost.com. This week, comparing PCs and Macs, AI and your OS, or AI teachers.
Good afternoon, Gary.
Hey, Leo. How's it going?
From a very, very wet Seattle. We're living up to our reputation again.
Oh, it's wet here, too.
We're supposed to be getting something like an inch and a half of rain just today. So,
oh yeah, not
good time to stay inside and stay warm and record a podcast.
Yes, podcasting weather, they call it.
It is exactly podcasting weather. although I hear that there are some podcasters who actually like go outside and record them on the walk, which I just
that kind of boggles the mind. Complications with the microphone and all sorts of stuff. Oh well.
We've
got lots of news over in your part of the world, both geographically and kind of in terms of area of expertise.
Yes, of course, the old I'm a PC or a Mac kind of thing. It's funny because I actually don't react to it as big news. I've talked about this before, that one of the things that Apple really has going for it is that they really do have these great events that are guaranteed to get them headlines. They're always there's kind of an expectation, a predictability, all that kind of stuff. I mean, they do that kind of stuff good. And it's mostly because they're releasing hardware and software. Mm-hmm. In Microsoft's case, of course, that's not as common because, we're releasing another version of Windows. Well, that happens every week almost. But this time they announced new versions of the Microsoft Surface PC, a couple of laptops. They're nice looking little machines, but they're branded with this new thing called Copilot Plus. Mm-hmm. And it looks like Copilot Plus PCs are I don't know if you want to call it a new, like I said, brand or a new something that you need to have certain hardware requirements in order to be able to brand your machine this way. Mm-hmm. Because it's not just Microsoft that is releasing these. The Surface machines got the press, but in fact, there are a number of other computer manufacturers who are releasing similar machines, similarly branded machines at the same time. Part of me is, like I said, they're nice machines, but they don't really get me all that excited. As always, they're, smaller, lighter, faster. The big difference that I think most people don't realize is that these are running on the Snapdragon CPU, not the x86 family of CPUs.
Right,
so it's
yes.
Basically stepping away from Intel. And this has always kind of concerned me. We've had a couple of aborted forays into non-Intel platforms in the past. And by Intel, I mean Intel compatible. Of course, AMDs qualify as well. But Snapdragon, of course, is a smaller, lighter, faster, but different CPU architecture. Mm-hmm. They've been doing this for a while. There actually are previous versions of the Surface that are running older versions of the Snapdragon. My big concern whenever this happens is, great, what about all this x86 software that I've invested in for the past 20 years?
Right.
And as it turns out, apparently, with Windows 11 only, there's a reasonable emulator so that you're not really throwing away your investment. And the fact that the CPU itself is apparently quite snappy, so to speak, it's actually not as big a pain as one might think. At least that's what they're saying. Of course, the proof is in the actual implementation and people actually experiencing this, which I don't think anybody has done yet. I've linked for the show notes both the Microsoft page that talks about their two new Surfaces, and then also the Qualcomm page, which is the manufacturer of the Snapdragon processor, talking about the Snapdragon and all the other manufacturers that are releasing new hardware with that in mind.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the interesting thing about it is that certainly on the Microsoft page, they are leveraging this concept of designed for AI, which, again, it's kind of old news to you, right? It's basically they're catching up with the M processors because the big thing for these Snapdragons is that, yeah, they've got neural processing units. In fact, they have had for a little while. But this one, of course, is, again, bigger, faster, cheaper, et cetera. So the promise is there, designed for AI. What I find interesting, though, is that today, if you purchase one of these machines, the only thing that I can see that Microsoft is promoting as a tangible benefit from these NPUs are essentially generally increased performance, which is great, and AI-enhanced cameras. And that's it, which bothers me. I mean, I get it. It's you know, like I said, it's designed for AI. It's ready for all this software to be written, I guess. But the actual software that really, really leverages the AI and the NPUs and so forth doesn't seem like it's really there yet.
Right.
So, you know, my bottom line on most of these machines right now is wait and see. I mean, I think, like I said, I think they're nice machines. I think they will turn out to be relatively good. They actually apparently have, because of the Snapdragon processor, they are significantly less power hungry. So they're now talking about, you know, a day or two of battery life in usage, which I think is pretty good. I don't know how that compares to the Macs, but I think we're at least on a par there. But other than that, it's kind of, okay, great. Yeah, you're catching up with Apple. That's great. You should do that. But exactly how well this is going to turn out is going to be still to be seen. So I wasn't sure if you had a chance to look at those guys, but how do you think they compare to what Apple's already had out?
Well, it's hard to tell. I mean, it really, you know, the big story on my side of things was all the noise that Microsoft and Qualcomm made about how these new Surface, you know, machines, they're trying to match the M3 MacBook Air, right? Apparently, there was an hours and hours long demo where they ran through benchmarks and tests comparing the M3 MacBook Air to the Surface with the new Snapdragon in it with Windows 11 and all that. And, you know, I thought it was interesting, first of all, that, you know, I guess on the Apple side of things, the feeling was that, oh, these M series processors are far ahead of what's available for like the lower end PC laptops. And here you have Microsoft saying, oh, by the way, that's true. You know, the last couple of years, by the way, in case, you know, we've never really said that, but it's true. We're way behind. But now we have something that matches it. And, you know, they showed a lot of things, you know, being comparable to it and all that, which I thought, well, okay, that's fine. You know, I mean, to be comparable to it, you know, it probably should be. I mean, it's kind of, they compete against each other. So you're going to have this kind of race. They're going to be neck and neck all the time. But also, you know, the funny thing is that the Apple processors, that's like the low end of the Apple processors. And I understand that the Surface is like the low end of PCs too, right?
Right.
So it's not like they're saying, oh, our high end compares to Apple's low end. No, they're saying we now have an affordable, you know, device for consumers that compares to Apple's affordable device for consumers. So, you know, I thought that was interesting. It's harder to compare. It occurred to me it's hard to compare at the high end, you know, against any other high end. Because where do you stop, right? Because you could go and say, let's take the Mac Studio with like reasonable specs, something you would actually pay for, like somebody who works using their Mac. And let's compare that to something that, like, you know, on the Windows side of things. But either one, you can go crazy, right? You can get a Mac Pro with a ton of memory and like an 8 terabyte SSD. And I mean, all this stuff and go 5 digits. And you could do the same thing on the PC side. So it's the high end is so nebulous, like as to where the high is, but the low end is much more easier to measure. It's much easier to go and say the new, you know, Microsoft Surface Copilot Plus PCs with Snapdragon versus the M3 MacBook Air. It's like these are, you know, these are things you could more easily compare. You can go and say, look, you can't go lower than these on, you know, for consumers, really.
The interesting thing, though, is that, I mean, they did release two studios. One is Studio and the other is Studio Pro. I did not take a close look at the specification differences between the two. It's typically a faster processor, more built-in RAM, that kind of stuff. Not unlike, you know, the Mac equivalents. I'm just wondering, you know, I'm assuming that in their demo, they used the Pro. You know, the fastest version of the Surface that they could do. And they compared it to something, but that right now for PCs on the Snapdragon processor, well, that's the high end, right? That's what you can get. You know, Mac, the Apple, you know, in that, especially in that same form factor, there's just, you know, the Apple machines are still ahead of the game, and Microsoft continues to play, or PC manufacturers in general continue to play catch up. Right. Not that catch-up isn't a bad thing. I mean, the interesting thing about this particular machine, especially with the emulation, assuming that that turns out to work, is that it means that folks who are invested in the PC platform, who need to use the PC platform, now have a direction they can head that gets them, you know, more or less equivalent performance, which, you know, what kind of sort of catches up with Macs. So I don't know, like I said, it's one of those things where I looked at it and I just sort of, you know, yep, nice machine. I just wasn't really blown away by it. It just continues, the race continues.
Sure. And I think, you know, as long as the two remain close enough, there's that, you know, thing where you're not going to switch. I mean, you were saying like investment in your software, but there's also investment in your skills.
Right.
And the thing is if you are invested in, you know, a decade or three decades of Windows skills, it's going to hurt to move to Mac. You're going to have to learn new stuff and vice versa. But, you know, at a period where it was like, oh, the new MacBook Airs are so much more powerful than a comparable, you know, PC laptop, you know, Intel PC laptop, then you say, well, maybe it's worth it. Maybe I should switch. But now that Microsoft has closed that gap, you know, it's easy to go and say, nope, I can stick with my Windows skill, my Windows knowledge, and the fact that, you know, I'm a virtuoso at getting things done in Windows. And, you know, I've got a new machine that I could, you know, get.
Funny, because there's actually an interesting audience where the transition cost, while it is there for sure, isn't nearly as high. And I say that because, you know, I'm a great example of somebody who invested 30 years in understanding Windows. But I transition back and forth between it and the Mac all the time. But my wife, for example, is not that person. But her usage of the machine is so, I don't want to say limited, but it is so focused. She does certain things and certain things only. And these are certain things that honestly aren't dramatically impacted by the change between Windows. And I even had her on Chrome OS for a while. And she's now running, I think, an M1 MacBook Air that you know, she's perfectly happy with. And the transition, you know, it has a few bumps, but because she's not really a power user of any sort, it's not that horrible transition. But then she's also not the kind of a person who would dramatically benefit from the increased power or the neural processing.
Sure. I kind of found out this week how, like, the gap in my knowledge between Mac and Windows is probably the biggest gap it's ever been, because I actually wanted to get some screenshots of something on Windows to show, like, oh, you know, if you're a Windows user, this is what menus look like, and a Mac user, this is what they look like, do a comparison. So I booted into Windows for the first time, and I can't even remember. It's been a long time. And certainly the first time that I actually went and tried to use Windows itself. Like, I've done things in the past where I've just booted into Windows just to look at something in a web browser,
right,
or just to run a specific app. So all I really needed Windows for was to launch the app. This time I was actually trying to use Windows, you know, okay, taskbar, let me look at some menus, let me look at some of the stock apps, that kind of thing. And I was looking and I was like, wow, I don't think it's so much that Windows has changed. I think any Windows skills I had have really atrophied.
I would expect it to be both, to be honest, because Windows, I don't know, which Windows were you running?
I was actually using Windows 10. So I can't even blame Windows 11 for it. I just was very, I felt, I felt it was, it felt very different. I mean, maybe it's, there's also some new things. Like one of the things I did, I was looking at one of the apps I opened was OneNote, and another app I opened was Paint 3D, which is like a stock app. And I found the interfaces, the, how the menus and toolbars worked. I was like, what is going on here with these apps?
Yep.
I was just, I was lost. And I'm sure if I was like, okay, I need to figure this out because I need it for something, it would have taken me, you know, 10, 15 minutes and I would have been up to speed. But, you know, from the years and years ago when I used to use Windows some, and then, you know, a decade or so where I had Windows available for gaming and for testing on a pretty constant basis, I've just been very immersed in the Mac world and found that I, you know, am very lost using Windows. I probably feel way more at home using various Linux operating systems. I mean, probably like Ubuntu and such.
Right,
such.
Right.
I could probably, feel right at home here. But going over to Windows, I mean, just even just looking at the tasks bar, the taskbar, and seeing all the different things that were available in the taskbar, and trying to wrap my head around, like, okay, so I probably need the taskbar for this, but where? Like, it's a whole ecosystem to itself, it almost seems. So
anyway, I will claim that it's I'm sure in part it's your own skills atrophy, but to be totally honest, Windows, even Windows 10 from, you know, from you probably never played with 8, you probably played with 7 or XP. The differences are fairly dramatic, and what you experienced is something that I've heard from a lot of native Windows users, where they've gone from one version to the next, and I don't want to say they're totally lost, because they have a little bit of a grasp of what the concepts are, at least, but things have moved, menus are hidden. I mean, there's just all sorts of stuff that's different enough to cause some consternation, especially in the folks that aren't necessarily power users or really interested in learning it all in detail.
Yeah, one app I even used, it may have, I don't think it was OneNote. Maybe it was. The menu was actually in a little hamburger menu. You know, the three lines, like in you know, an Android or iOS app. Which is interesting. When I realized that's what was going on, I was like, oh, the interface here is kind of like a mobile interface, even though I'm in Windows.
Right.
Yet this is something that Apple gets called out for constantly. Oh, they're making my favorite Mac app look more like the iPhone version, when in fact it's not. It's like, no, it's still got a menu bar. It still does all the things. You just don't like that they changed the name of something, you know, and here on Windows, I'm seeing, no, this is actually like really like a mobile app, even though
Windows
I'm on a desktop.
You missed the joy that was Windows 8, because they were trying to make Windows a desktop and tablet operating system at the same time.
Oh,
and that's
okay.
where I think a lot of these mobile-like interfaces came from.
Interesting.
I don't want to call it a disaster, but it was not well received, and they've backed off on many of the decisions that they made with Windows 8. I think the one I think that you will laugh about is that one of the things, just being entrenched in Windows for decades, even before Windows, the DOS equivalent apps, was there's a menu bar across the top, and you know, of your application. And in a bunch of applications now, it's not there.
Yeah, I noticed.
Except if you press and release the Alt key, then all of a sudden the menu bar appears. So that's an intuitive interface, right? It's just, and then let's see. So this is true for Windows File Explorer. They did that with Windows 10. With Windows 11, the menu bar is truly gone. There's nothing. There's only what's available on the, what they now call the ribbon across the top. But yeah, there has been much change over the
years. Well, that explains a lot, because that was actually what I was doing specifically. I was looking at the menu bar. My very simple premise for my video was, Windows has the menu bar at the top of each window, and Mac has the menu bar at the top of the screen.
Yes.
And then I was surprised when I went looking for examples that I was like, Windows has the menu bar. Name the app first, because it seems to be different everywhere. At least, you know, Mac's got the consistency. I just don't know. Like, part of me is like, you know what, Gary, you need to go and maybe set aside some time, and maybe just spend like, you know, a day or a weekend or something immersed in Windows and relearn Windows, because it would make me better at doing Mac most if I understood like maybe the current Windows 11, everything mm-hmm. in it. And another mm-hmm. part of me is like, no, at this point, I'm so immersed that like my brain runs on Mac OS. And this is like my superpower, right? Is like, yeah. I could see like, oh, somebody has a problem, or I think of a problem and I could see the solution
yep.
using Mac OS
yep.
because I'm so immersed in it. And I would ruin that if I tried to like spread wider and like, you know, understood Windows more. So I don't know.
It's funny. I'm reluctant to say that my brain runs on Windows just because that has a lot of, one of these days I'm going to blue screen. But yes, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
I've always been kind of a breath guy anyway. So I'm comfortable in all three platforms, Windows yeah. and Mac and Linux. But absolutely the expertise that really I can bring to bear on people's problems really does focus on Windows. And it's exactly the same thing. You know, you get halfway through a problem description and you already know, you know, which setting needs to be changed. That's right.
Yep.
So anyway, one of the interesting things about the whole announcement, and in fact, about just the discussion of AI in general over the past few months, is that they are, I'm not even sure how best to put it. They're trying to, or they're at least implying that they are going to integrate AI with the operating system. In Microsoft's terminology, that's Copilot. There is now currently a Copilot app you can run on your PC that does not just the usual, you know, query response kind of stuff that we've been doing with ChatGPT, but it also apparently will like fire up the Windows app you need to solve a particular problem that you described. For example, I just asked it to, change my wallpaper. And it tells me, or change my background image is what I said. And Copilot responds by saying, I've attempted to open the personalization background settings page for which you know, can change your password, your wallpaper. And in fact, it did, which is, I think, a sign of at least where some things are going to go, you know, in terms of problem solving. You know, I need to do this. I don't know where it is, or I don't know how. And, you know, maybe Copilot will be able to do not just a better job of describing it, but perhaps even holding your hand through the process. At some point, I expect it may very well say, instead of, you know, here's where you do it, I would love to say, okay, what wallpaper do you want to see? And just have it do it for me.
Right.
But ultimately, that got me to thinking, artificial intelligence in an operating system.
Mm-hmm.
Why? What would you do with it? I mean, there's certainly the concept of moving all of those big AI apps that we talk about all the time, you know, ChatGPT, Gemini, Stable Diffusion, all those guys, making them local, which, okay, that's cool. It doesn't represent new functionality, but it does represent, you know, new perhaps privacy or, you know, new abilities that you could just run more quickly on your own machine. But is there stuff that's really, really more operating system specific that I'm just not thinking about where AI could be implemented or could actually add value? I don't know. I tried to think about it some, and I'm not really coming up with any great scenarios, but that just could be my own lack of imagination.
I think you hit on it with your first example, that changing the wallpaper and stuff. Both Mac and Windows, there are a ton of settings. And people complain all the time of not being able to find them, not knowing where they are. AI can make easy work of that because it seems like a really large set of things to know. There's probably hundreds of different individual settings in an operating system. Hundreds to us seems like a lot. How can you possibly know where this stuff is? But right. to an AI, that's a tiny number. And I think if, you know, like, because I'm also looking forward to hopefully Apple integrating AI into Mac OS and iOS and all of that. And this would be a great place for it to be. Why should I have to go, you know, into my settings, go to the right place in settings to change something like the wallpaper or to change something like, you know, turning, you know, some setting on or off or making the menu bar text bigger or whatever. I should be able to ask AI to do it. And AI should have a finite number of answers where it could be like, oh, you want me to change this setting for you? I ran into it the other day. You know, I know Siri is not AI. Siri is very much not a large language model now.
Right.
Hopefully it is. I in the car the other day, my phone hooked up to the car via CarPlay, and I was doing something at a light, and I saw it flash on the screen for like a second. It said, all directions, alerts only. That's like what my brain saw, and my finger hit the alerts only. And I was like, ooh, I know, what was that? And from that point on, I could not get any talking directions, right? It would show me on the screen, turn left. It won't tell me. And I was like, I changed something. I hit something and changed something. I looked through the settings. I looked everywhere. I could not find where to set it back. And I, in desperation, knowing it would not work, I asked Siri, why are directions not talking to me? And I did it like, you know, I phrased it like five different ways. And Siri is like, no idea, no idea. I eventually found the setting. It was a button right on the screen.
Right.
You know, but I was like, this is a solution for AI built into the operating system. I should be able to ask Siri that, and it say, oh, maybe you changed this setting, and bring it up on the screen and let me change it. Or just, would you like me to change it for you? Having that would be a huge thing. I think it would be big enough to really be like a flagship feature of a new version of either Windows or Mac OS or iOS or Android. If you could just have complete AI, you know, control, basically just translating what you're saying to doing settings, but then even other stuff on the screen, because Apple's got lots of accessibility functions and they've been expanding them every year. There's more and more you can do with your voice, with voice control, not AI. You have to know the right thing to say and it will do it. You know, you need to know how to address things on the screen. And it's just doing commands, voice commands with no intelligence behind it at all.
Right.
But they have the hooks there. So they can control the operating, you know, everything on the screen with something other than the mouse and keyboard. Now they just got to hook that up to AI so that I don't have to know the exact right thing to say. I could say, move this window to the top left corner. And if the AI isn't sure, say, which window? Do you mean the window with your Pages document? Yes, move that one. Okay. And then it moves it. Like, I should be able to do that. And if I could just do a bunch of stuff like that to control the very finite number of things I see going on the screen with my voice, it saves you from having to figure out, oh, what do I do to do that? Where do I drag from? How do I resize it? Is it the side or the corner I grab? All this stuff that confuses people now. I think it could be a huge thing. And I'd love to see that happen in any or all of the operating systems. I don't know if it's going to. I don't know what, you know, it's a big mystery to me what the plans are for Apple to include AI. I've tried to play with ChatGPT's Mac app. I still don't have access to it. Others seem to, because I see a bunch of YouTube videos, frustrating YouTube videos because they're not trying the things I want them to try. It's like, oh, try this. Oh, no, they're not going to do that. And it's like, damn it. Yeah, OpenAI, give me access so I can try that. Yeah, as of this afternoon, when we're recording this, I still can't log in the app. So I still don't have access. But looking at the videos, like one of the things you could do is you could be coding, for instance, or writing, you know, and then you could take a screenshot and send it into the app and say, summarize this or whatever. And it will do it. And that, you know, is good. It removes a few steps, but I want it to be like kind of live. If I granted access, like I want it to be looking at the screen and I just want to be able to say oh, so this paragraph I just wrote, do you have any suggestions? And it should like have been looking and know which paragraph I had just written and know what it says, and then come up right away with like, oh, you have a run-on sentence here or something like that. That would be really cool if it could do that. And but it doesn't look like the app's quite there yet. Maybe they're waiting for the integration in the next version of macOS. I don't know. And one interesting note is that there seems to be a lot of screenshotting going on now with AI. And screenshotting is like a really bad technology. It's taking the screen and converting it to pixels.
Right.
for like easy, it's like you can send this to anybody because it's the standard format. And people use screenshotting for all sorts of bad things. Like, for instance, they don't know how to edit their photo. So they do some things and they screenshot it and they think, oh, I've cropped the photo because I took a screenshot of it. And right. It's like, no, you just downgraded the quality of the photo immensely by doing that.
Dramatically. Yeah.
Yeah. But people do it all the time. And AI has kind of got the same thing where you can do all this stuff with screenshotting now. And then it's relying on the AI, the software to go and do, image to text translation, figure out what the text is, and then process the text. What I think would be really cool is if all the operating systems would come up with kind of like the PDF of screenshot technology. Instead of just taking pixels, there's some sort of descriptors that are underlying what's on the screen. So if there's like a block of text, like you have an app like Microsoft Word open, and there's a bunch of text on the screen at a certain point, sure, the pixels are all there, but also sent to like some sort of special operating system thing is like, oh, by the way, at this position on the screen is this text, and here's the actual text. And then when you ask for a screenshot, you can get that. It's almost like metadata that's part of the screenshot. Here's the actual text. Here's the actual colors and the actual, this is where this image comes from. And there's a web page shown, and this is the actual URL. You don't have to, OCR the URL at the top. You can actually get that somewhere.
So I wonder if your metaphor of a PDF-like thing is perhaps closer to a correct design than anything else, because when you, for example, print to PDF, it very often is storing exactly that kind of information in the document.
Yeah.
Yes, sometimes it's storing bitmaps. I get that, but a lot of the times it's not. It's actually storing the what you would consider to be the metadata. So yeah, that would be very interesting.
Sometimes there are certain letters that can even good OCR. Like if you're using the right font, the letter R and the letter N next to each other is almost pixel identical to the letter M.
Right.
Things like that. And I'm afraid it's like, oh, is all this sophisticated AI going to rely on translating pixels to text? I mean, come on, we can do better.
Right. Yep. Absolutely. Yeah. So while you were talking about some of this, I have the Copilot app running next to me, running here. And that's the one where I had asked it, change my background image, and it told me how.
Yeah.
One of the other options that it had was to summarize the contents of the window currently being shown in Microsoft Edge.
Okay.
Which implies that it actually has access to the contents of that window, which I thought was kind of interesting. In our case, it's our notes, right, for this episode. And it did a small summary. Maybe 50 words or so, podcast episode is the TEH podcast, main topics, additional segments, future topics, the kinds of stuff that are in that document, which, like I said, it implies that it actually does, in fact, have live access to the real data. The other thing that's kind of interesting is that one of the follow-on suggested questions, it basically offers me some questions that I can ask Copilot by just clicking on the question. And one of the suggested one is clearly context dependent. It derived from what it saw. What's the latest news on Microsoft Surface? So it's various apps are getting various places. I have hope. I don't, it's difficult for me to envision the average user really going deep in the state of things we have now, but especially, given the what you just described, basically handling things like options and hidden settings and all that kind of stuff more seamlessly in terms that people actually use rather than having to know the arcane terms that things are actually listed as. And having AI have true access to the data, not just the pictures, there's potential here. I'll go that far now and say that there's a fair amount of potential what might happen here.
Yeah, certainly, hopefully getting closer to the whole Star Trek computer voice thing. It would be nice. I don't know. There's a lot of potential. I think the next 2 years is going to be really interesting. I say 2 years because I really feel that with the Microsoft Copilot stuff and the Apple, like, you know, the next version of Mac OS and iOS, they're going to take some steps, and but they're going to be afraid to go too far. Like, like you said, bring up the here's where you can change your desktop background, but I'm not going to do it for you, you know, kind of thing.
It's still your responsibility to do it correctly. Yes.
You got to do it. I'm not going to take responsibility for this. But
that reminds me a lot of how I work. People will occasionally ask me to, you know, do you remote connect to my computer and fix something for me? I said, heck no. The last person to touch it always gets the blame, and I will not be the last person to touch it. So,
so speaking of AI,
seems to be the topic today. Yeah.
Well, for the last year and a half, the, So we had a couple. We had a mutual friend of ours send us a video of a TED Talk about AI and education, and we've talked about it before. Actually, I've had a note of like something to talk about regarding this. You know, the idea of like using AI in education as kind of a teacher or a teacher supplement or a homework helper or whatever. It's always been very interesting to me. One of the first things I did with ChatGPT when it came out was use it to just have a kind of student teacher talk. I used like history as a good, you know, good example there. But a lot of the more current examples are like teaching you how to do math or science. And some of the stuff, stuff demonstrated in the last 2 weeks from various companies have been really good because it's demonstrating the use of AI to not give you the answer, but to explain things to you and to be very much like, I'm not going to do this for you, but I'll tell you, I'll help you with the steps and I'll let you do the work. And then I'll tell you if you got it right and explain things a little bit more in all of this. And it's done, there's some great demos for that. And it's very easy to try on your own. History is even easier because you could just ask about stuff. And then the cool thing about it is you can go off in any direction you want. Whereas like solving a math problem, you know, here's how to do it. And we're going to explain it and get through it. And you'll learn how to do it. History, you could start with one topic and then you could just dig deeper in any direction you want. And AI can take you anywhere you want, which is great for things like history, where history is so big that, you know, especially if you're talking like grade school or high school, you're not going to go and just teach the whole breadth of history. But students do individual little research into things that they like. And the idea is to learn about history through things you're interested in. So you could ask about a topic in history, like say, you know, the American Revolutionary War or something, and then it'll mention a specific event and you could ask more information about that event. And then you could ask about a person and then you could ask more about that person and find out that they did something else and then find out about that thing and then learn, end up going this whole thing where you learn all this stuff, but you're only asking things that interest, you know, about things that interested to you, right? And it's great stuff. And I think, it's got a huge potential for this, like a lot of sci-fi books I've read from decades ago about having AI teachers. One of the things, though, that I learned, I'm not a teacher, and I really don't know what it's like to be a teacher in front of a classroom. I do know what it's like to be a parent who's helping their kid with homework. And I think I'm pretty smart when it comes to math and science and maybe even some other things. But in having to help my child with homework from first or second grade or whenever homework started, all the way to, say, 12th grade, where, you know, I reached the limits of my knowledge in various subjects, I learned that knowing how to do something is the second most important thing that you need to teach somebody or help them with their homework. The most important thing is patience, which I don't have any. And the idea is that, like, if I was helping my child with something, I just was not patient enough to be able to explain and have her, you know, learn the material like her teacher was. AI, though, exceeds at this. You know, it's so good at being patient. And it's better than even the most patient teacher. It'll spend all day just doing it. And I think that is where it could really excel, You're one-on-one with the AI. The AI will re-explain things over and over again, try in different ways, go down to even more basics, take steps back as long as it takes at your speed with infinite patience, never getting impatient at all. So anyway, I think that's something I haven't really seen talked about, like in that video or in other places.
There's a related aspect to it that came to mind for me, and that is that AIs aren't judgmental.
Yeah,
it's related to patients, but they're not judgmental, and I think that that's something that could conceivably make students more comfortable. They know that they're dealing with a machine. They know that they are not, that there's not some person there that's somehow thinking less of them because they're struggling with something. There's just this inanimate thing that they're interacting with. The only time that can turn into a problem, and I could see this happening long term, initially I'm hoping it won't, but at some point, when these kind of AI tutors, and I love that as the model, when these kind of AI personalized tutors come along and start helping students, if they're ever in a position where an organization like a school needs them to keep records of how the student is doing, then while the judgmental piece of it may not feel as direct or as intimate, there's still this reflection of, or this potential for being concerned about not doing as well with the tutor and having that somehow be reflected to people who actually will judge you.
Yeah, I wonder where it'll go with that. I have to think that, you know, a large portion of the educational system doesn't care, right? Like if you're, I don't want to say public school, because some public schools are excellent. But, you know, if you're at a school where the teachers maybe aren't paid as well and the school district isn't run as well, you know, the whole thing of like, how is the student doing? They're probably not caring too much now is the problem. They're not going to suddenly start caring. Maybe at the higher end, you lose some of that. You know, you're going to a high teacher to student ratio school, private school or something, where they're going to maybe look into that. Maybe it just has to change. You know, they always say, you know, different people learn at different speeds.
Right.
This could be a way to equalize that.
Yes.
So you could be sure you can go home and learn what you need to learn in a half an hour and go and play outside. And then somebody else takes 2 hours to learn the same material. Then the next day, they're at the same point.
Yes.
So does it really matter? And maybe it's not even, maybe that doesn't even relate to like how much the student truly understood the material or even how much they enjoyed it. You know, the person that learned faster may have a more shallow understanding and may not really be that interested, except that I need this for the test. And the person that took longer may actually have a deeper understanding.
Right.
And may actually really care about the material. Maybe the reason they took 2 hours was because they were fascinated by it.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't want to rush through it. And they were like, oh, okay, I get how to do this math problem. Now I want to understand why. Why does it work like that, right? And then they get a deeper education. And I don't know, it could be a lot of interesting things. But yeah, it's going to be really, I like the idea, like you said, of thinking of it as an AI tutor. Maybe the eventual thing is that, you know, human teachers are always the first point, but the AI tutors are what level the playing field, because you can go off on your own and they're kind of democratic in that everybody's got them. Right. If you make them cheap enough, which, of course, that was the whole thing OpenAI talked about. Right. But the idea is that it doesn't matter if, you know, there's the student that goes home and their parents are rich and they can hire an expensive tutor to work with you. And then there's the student that goes home that doesn't have that luxury. And with AI, it may not matter anymore. Both students may have access to the same AI.
The other thing is that given the current teacher shortage. I wonder also if this is a way to, I mean, that's a huge problem that has a whole bunch of other things that contribute to it. But this is one of those things that potentially could also help alleviate at least some of it.
It could. And I think the mistake some people make is they think it would be on the low end. Like, so you have a school district that's overwhelmed and the students are doing poorly. Let's have AI teach a lot of these kids because we don't have enough teachers. It may actually be the high end. It may be the students that are doing really well that are like, I don't need the teachers. I can go off and learn on my own, sit me in front of an AI. And now you don't have to, I don't have to take up a seat in that math class because I'm just doing the AI tutor for the math class. I'm learning all the stuff. My tests reflect that. And the teachers, the human teachers, can actually help the students that are having more difficulty with the subject or maybe learn in a way that the AI isn't good at teaching yet, you know? So, because, you know, humans could be a little, maybe adjust a little bit better. It's going to be fascinating to see all the stuff. That video that we were both talking about, that I see you put a link to in the notes. I mean, yes. One of the things it talked about is, you know, a revolution in education, like maybe has never been seen before. And that could be true because, like, you know, if you think about it, even with all the technology and all the stuff that we have today, I know that the students basically still do the same thing that we did, which is basically the same thing they did 100 years before. You go sit in a classroom and there's a teacher that teaches you. Maybe we have a little more advanced toys now, but it really hasn't changed much. But now AI could actually really be a huge switch from that.
To be clear, the video we're talking about is called How AI Could Save, Not Destroy Education. And it's by it's a TED Talk by Sal Khan, who I believe is the guy who created Khan Academy.
Yeah, yeah.
So he's kind of sort of got a vested interest in this online education model. But I think it's in a good way. I think that, you know, he has already made some very interesting inroads in making various forms of education more accessible. So I do appreciate his approach on this.
Yep. Cool.
So that's cool. Let's talk about other things that are cool.
Yeah, other things, yeah.
So one of the things I had back from the our Christmas break when we took a month off, I decided to go ahead and bring forward, and that is, of all things, All Creatures Great and Small.
Oh,
that is a TV series. I think it's in like second or third series now or season now on. I think it's on PBS Masterpiece. I'm finding it on Amazon, Amazon Prime, possibly with the PBS, but it's on your local PBS stations as well. This is a series based on the books from James Herriot, All Creatures Great and Small. It's a series of, I think, four books, if I remember correctly. What I find interesting is that I came into this with prejudice because we were religious watchers of the TV series, All Creatures Great and Small, from the BBC about 25 years ago, right?
Yep,
completely different set of actors. Yep,
yeah.
Completely different set of actors. Essentially many of the same stories, certainly, the same characters. And I have been pleasantly surprised. I was expecting to really do a lot of comparing against the previous episode, the previous series. But in reality, I'm just really, really enjoying this. And I can recommend it to anybody who just loves animals, as it's very cool that way. But it's actually a very nice period piece as well for this area in England during what starts out between the First and Second World Wars and goes through the Second World War and some of the issues dealt with in there. So, like I said, All Creatures Great and Small on PBS and available through Amazon.
Cool. I want to thank you for your recommendation a couple months ago of the Rook series by Daniel O'Malley. I'm just finishing up the third book. Uh-huh. It's the Rook, Stiletto, and Blitz. It's a great little, I guess you would call it fantasy. Like it takes place modern day.
Ish.
But it's got fantasy elements, but it's not, don't think Harry Potter. Think, I don't know. Sometimes it reminds me a little bit of like if Lovecraft were alive today. Like what he would write. And it's interesting too, because the author has come up with a really unique way to tell lots and lots of tiny short stories. The books are filled with tangents, right? Yes. You remember, and sometimes they're like 3 pages long, approximately. I'm doing audiobooks, so I don't know. Sometimes they're about 3 pages, sometimes they're like 30 pages, and they happen out of nowhere. It'll just be somebody will mention, oh, this is kind of like what happened back in 1820. And then right. the next thing you know, I'm listening for an hour to a completely unrelated story of something that happened a long time ago.
Right.
And it's every single one of them has been worth it. That's the thing. It's never like, oh, another tangent. No, they're all like fascinating little things that don't always just tie into the main story at all. They're just really interesting. Anyway, they're kind of fun books that are hard. They're really long, but hard to put down. I'm enjoying them.
Yep. I have no idea if there's another one coming or not. I'm kind of hoping someday it will be.
Could keep writing those forever, really, the way that it's structured.
They did do a TV series of The Rook.
What? I did not know that.
Yes. It's not available on any of the streaming services right now, but you can buy it on Amazon. However, before you go there, I've read some of the reviews, and apparently it is the concept, but not necessarily the story, if that makes any sense.
Well, that's fine. You can just treat it as like a new part.
Yeah. It's kind of the way I described, not Lord of the Rings, but the Hobbit movies. It's a very familiar set of characters in a very familiar place telling a very different story.
Interesting. Okay.
Blatant self-promotion. So the article I'm going to point people to this week is Use the Cloud, but Don't Rely on the Cloud. It's askleo.com/170468. This is one of those things where occasionally people get a little bit too, I don't want to say trusting, but they do get a little bit too complacent in the sense that they will store a lot of information in cloud services of various sorts. And that could, I mean, it's not limited to things like OneDrive or Dropbox. Those could be Google Photos. It could be Flickr. It could be your email, any of that kind of stuff, without the realization or without thinking through the fact that stuff happens. It could be a provider's problem. You could lose your account. I mean, there's all sorts of different things. So as is one of my themes, the thing that I, of course, end up harping on is backing things up, right? Just copying things to a cloud service is not a backup. And I discuss more about why and what you should do about it.
Well, I'll point to two videos because they're kind of a pair about how to do translations on the Mac, and the other one's on the iPhone. And these are about the built-in system-wide translations. So they don't rely on like the app having any of that built in, just being able to select text and say, translate this, both on the reading, but also on writing. So if you want to send a message to somebody, you could just type it in English, select, say, translate this to Spanish, and it translates it. If you've ever wondered how to use those tools on Mac or your iPhone, I've got a pair of videos for that.
Any sense of how good the translation is?
I sense they're pretty good. Unfortunately, I have no really good way to judge.
Right.
I think they're, when you're reading, I think it's fine because you get an idea of what's going on. Like I've tried translating whole news stories and been like, oh, okay, I can, I'm not having any problem understanding. And when you're, if you're actually communicating the other way, you're probably not translating a whole page of text. You're probably just translating a quick message in response to somebody. And it seems to be fine. I think it's pretty advanced. It is going to be interesting to see, since AI is a whole other way to do translations.
Yes.
If Apple's going to embrace AI, are they going to switch systems? Because they only have a certain number of languages and they add more every year, just like Google has been doing just for 20 years more than Apple has. So will Apple just continue to build out their current translation system, or are they basically going to freeze it now and say, we'll just switch over to using AI and take advantage of AI being able to translate, all this stuff.
Anything to anything. Yeah.
Yeah. So
interesting. Yeah. Now, it's funny. The reason I ask, of course, is because I've been down this path with English and Dutch. I understand enough Dutch to really, am able to see the translations and where they're just off the mark by a little bit. You're right. When you are translating something to read, there's a lot more flexibility. It doesn't matter if the grammar is wrong, as long as you get the concepts and the ideas. But when you're going the other way to someone who only speaks a foreign language that you don't understand, it's almost impossible to understand, you know, if you're getting all the nuances or you're not accidentally using an idiom that's offensive or any of those kinds of things, right?
Yeah, and Dutch is one of the languages, strangely, and I know that because there's only about 15 languages, and one of the comments to my video was complaining that Tagalog is not one of the languages, and saying how many more millions of people speak that as compared to Dutch. So why did Dutch get priority? It's like, I don't know. You have to ask Apple.
I know exactly why Dutch got priority. The Netherlands is an incredibly technological country.
Yeah.
There's basically everybody's using it for everything all the time. There's a lot of software development going on there. So I think maybe that it just has the advantage of being up there on the leading edge of technology.
It could
absolutely
be.
I agree with the population description for sure.
And it's got to be, I mean, there's obviously, you know, there are different character sets involved. And yes, Chinese is one of the languages that's there, and Japanese and Korean as well, which have all three have pretty large populations.
Right.
So you could see them being made a priority. My feeling is, if I had to take a wild guess, is that there are different teams for each of these, right? Although there may be groups. Maybe there's a team that does European languages, you know, and all of that. I don't know. But I have a feeling they're different teams, and the teams aren't necessarily lockstep into each other. You know, if the team working on the Philippines, it says they need 6 more months, they get 6 more months. And if the team working on Dutch says we're ready, then they do it. And they don't necessarily say, no, we're not going to do Dutch. I don't care if you're ready. We're going to do it in the order of population numbers. No, it's just how it works out.
Yep.
Yeah.
Very cool. Right. Well, I think that pretty much wraps us up for yet another week.
Yeah.
As always, thank you everyone for listening, and we will see you here again next. Well, I don't know if it's going to be next week or not. We'll see.
Soon.
We'll see you here again real soon. Let's put it that way. Take care, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye.
The show notes for this week are at tehpodcast.com/TEH221. If you have a comment or question for us, be sure to leave it on the show notes page. The TEH podcast is hosted by Leo Notenboom of AskLeo.com and Gary Rosenzweig of MacMost.com and edited by Connie Delaney. I'm your synthetic announcer, Adam, from 11labs.com. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you here real soon.